Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like monks at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
G'day, everyone.
It is the 20th of April, and this is episode 56. So, really cool show for you guys coming up. We're going to be talking to Andrew Bushnell, obviously huge friend of the podcast. A lot of people love when he is on.
One email saying how good his interview was, and he's just been talking about it ever since.
So,
he's got to back it up.
Yeah, shout out to the person that sent that email.
Don't do it again.
Yeah, please. So, we're going to be talking to him about a lot of things, the Greens' latest policy, the immigration report, and some other stuff we've got planned. We're also going to be airing part three, the end of the trilogy, Will They Save Middle Earth, of Professor Robert Toombs's interview with Dr. Bella DeBurra. And yeah, but huge week for news this week, but it's also a huge week for milestones, Pete. Now,
it is.
I want to cast our minds 10 years ago. Kevin Rudd just got in power and he realized that he didn't really have a whole lot of policies. He just sort of wanted to be in power. So got everyone in the country that he thought was a good ideas person, and they all went to Canberra and came up with the, what is it, like the 2020 Ideas Summit?
Australia 2020.
What it's called. Australia 2020. So if you're too young for that, basically just a big love-in of the intelligentsia of just going, oh, what's an Australian look like in 2020 and stuff like that.
My honours supervisor got invited.
Really? Mm. Did they go?
Yeah.
What was their idea?
I don't know. There was like 1,000 people that went.
Yeah, it was 1,000 people that went. And I don't wish to shock anyone that doesn't know about this, but not a whole lot of the ideas that were at the summit got off.
No.
I think the only ones that are sort of quoted are the National Disability Insurance Scheme, which obviously is like, you know, pretty controversial anyway. It's a lot, like there's a lot of waste in it. And also it was an idea that was had before the summit.
Whitlam
came up with it. And ABC Kids TV channel. That was another one that got up in the 2020 Ideas Summit. So
I went through...
It did change the game of the Australian media landscape.
That's right. Yeah. I went through the final report and found a couple of things which tickled my fancy, which I'm disappointed didn't get up. 1% of all portfolio budgets must be given to the arts.
Oh.
1%. So, you know, we can draw a picture of the Chinese as they march into China. 1% of the defence budget. As they march into Sydney, actually. It's okay, it doesn't work for China. The second one, and this is quoting word for word what was in the final report of the summit, endorse several freebie strategies to promote Australian culture overseas. What is that?
What's a freebie?
I don't know. It's freebie, just, is in the final report.
Yeah.
So John Oscar
said technically not a word.
Yeah, that's right. John Oscar said at the time, I think some of the ideas have merits, but those ideas have been around for decades, which is obviously very salient. And he said that the front government basically handpicked his hand-selected friends.
Yeah.
So that was John Roscombe on the ABC 10 years ago.
Yeah, well, what a bloke. Absolutely holds up. My favourite idea, if we're going to go favourite ideas, that the 2020 summit should be put in a time capsule was one of the ideas. Like, at the end of it, let's put this in a time capsule.
Well,
this comes from, I think it's The Mocker, this guy who like writes for The Australian, does all these satiric articles. The guy that came up with the time capsule idea pocketed 11 grand for that idea.
You're kidding me.
I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding that I read it. I'm obviously, like, if it went to print, let's take it as, you know, fact. But the guy that came up with the idea that we should put all this in a time capsule at the end pocketed 11 grand.
Time capsules really got crowded out by the internet, didn't they?
Yeah.
I can just Google the report now.
I'm sure there's a few time capsules that we were supposed to dig up from my primary school and no one went.
Yeah. I'm in a time capsule, but it's not going to be up until, like, I'm... into like, you know, another 90 years.
Wow.
And as an 8-year-old, facing my mortality was really yeah. was really full on.
Future archaeologists.
Like, so I'm going to be dead when this teacher was like, yes, you'll be dead.
And
so
everyone your friends. You love. And also the sun will one day eat the earth.
Yeah.
I'm like, future archaeologists are really going to think that our society was really hung up on telling people what your personality traits are in a drawing of your hand, which I feel was like an absolute time capsule staple.
Exactly. Right.
Anyway,
if
I got a guy 11 grand, I'm just going to start saying that if I'm ever in a meeting, just say this should be time capsuled, and hopefully someone says that's a good idea. Here's 11 grand.
Absolutely.
I mean, the cost benefit analysis of doing that in every meeting.
You should quit your job. Please quit your job. Anyway, let's move on. Sam Rahim, the Sydney barber. Who was taken to the, we think the Human Rights Commission, we actually couldn't work it out, but the Human Rights Commission, we think, Federal Circuit Court, anyway, for his...
At least a court that he shouldn't have been taken to,
for
in a perfect world.
For politely declining to cut a girl's hair because he's believed he wasn't qualified to cut females' hair. Anyway, so we talked about this last week, and it's been all over the news, so we won't go into too much detail, but we featured a link in Hay yesterday to support Sam's legal costs. He needs 50K. He's only on 20K at the moment. Little bump from Hayward that I missed, which is good. Thank you, listeners or readers. But yeah, jump on the IPA website or into Hay, what did I miss, to find that link.
Absolutely. I'm definitely not texting Andrew Bushnell to talk about what we're going to interview him about. Yeah, whatever Pete said was bang on the mark. Mm. As always, probably delivered a bit too low into the microphone, but we'll deal with that
couldn't
when
agree
we can.
With you more.
Okay, another big story from this week. I'm back in now. So have you been following the Michael Cohen story, Nina?
No, what's happening?
Okay, sorry. If you guys might have been seeing how there's like this whole legal showdown between Trump and former porn star Stormy Daniels as the money that Trump has sent Stormy Daniels. Well, anyway, it sort of fell to Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, to sort of deal with this issue. And there's been a few allegations that Michael Cohen might have like dipped his hand into Trump campaign funds in order to pay for Stormy Daniels' silence, which is very how you going. He says he didn't. So it's gone to the courts, and Michael Cohen has to sort of explain who his clients are to the courts. So that's all on the table. And he says, one of my clients is Trump. The other one is, the second is former Republican Deputy Finance Chairman of the Republican National Committee, Elliot Brody. And there was an unnamed third client. Mm-hmm. And the courts were sort of saying, okay, you need to tell us who that is. And he said, no.
That's not how this works, man.
And it's like, no. You need to tell us who that is. And turns out it was none other than Fox News host, Sean Hannity, mm-hmm. who had been strenuously saying that there's nothing to see here with the Michael Cohen story, everyone turn away. Very embarrassing. Like, Sean Hannity not once said, by the way, the guy's my lawyer.
Yeah.
And to the, like, and in fairness to Sean Hannity, he now says, I've never actually given him any money, but it's still like, he was the lawyer. Very embarrassing.
So this is a big story in the States.
Yeah. It's just like, Sean, come on, mate.
Sean Hannity having a mare, and we're still waiting to hear back from Stormy Daniels for that interview request. We're trying to get her on the line.
Yes, absolutely.
So stay tuned in for the coming weeks for that.
How is that going, Pete?
Well, hasn't replied.
Well, good luck. So another story we got. So Pete and I make a lot of fun of this show. Q&A Clap of the Week being our favourite segment. We do have one later in the show because we haven't done it for a little bit.
We have a lot of respect for Q&A, don't we, James?
Well, we respect it as a goldmine of material for us for this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
But we actually have genuine reason to tune in and watch and engage with the show on a philosophical basis rather than just like trying to source material
yep.
on Monday night when our esteemed benevolent leader, our executive director, John Roskin.
You can't say benevolent because everyone's like, oh, yeah, benevolent dictator. That's not what he meant.
The executive director of the IPA, John Roskin, friend of the show, came on last year. It was a really interesting chat. He'll be on Q&A on Monday. I think audience registration is still open, so make sure you go to the Q&A website.
Yes.
Register to be in the audience. Maybe you could ask a question. Maybe you could ask a question about Sam Rahim.
That's what we're pushing for,
That's what I really would like. Obviously, it should be the biggest story in Australia right now, but it isn't. And, so also tune in because John Roskin's going to put some harsh truths to people that aren't ready to hear them.
Maybe like when Simon went on and they did an actual clap for a really sound policy position.
Yeah.
That might happen again. And when we did our Q&A claps next week, we had to come up with actual sound positions, which was tough.
Yeah.
He's going to be on with Andrew Lee, Fiona
Nash.
Much easier
when we just make fun of them.
That's right. Rebecca Huntley and Jill Shepherd.
Yeah. So make sure you tune in for that. Now, last story we got. Pete, let's talk minimum wage.
Yes. Well, minimum wage. The ACT, you were claiming that their proposed 7.2 increase in the minimum wage will create 57,000 jobs, which is obviously an absolute Keynesian fantasy. Matthew Lesh crunched the numbers yesterday using research by Andrew Lee, and he reckons that, well, he knows that employment will actually fall by 115,000 if the minimum wage was increased by that much. Interestingly, there was a couple of interesting Twitter outcomes from this. James Patterson raised a good point, a friend of the podcast.
Yeah, Senator, we should have him back on.
Senator James Patterson, we should, said, if mandating higher wages increases employment, why stop at $50? Why not make it $1,000? Why not make it $1 million, James?
Yeah,
that's a bigger number.
Tim Wilson MP, also responded to that tweet saying, why not a billion kajillion?
Well,
which I think
true.
Is also a salient economic point.
That is a good point. So obviously this is ridiculous. Now, what I also like about this is, I didn't realise, but last Sunday, Lesh and Sally McManus, the head of the ACTU, engaged in a Twitter stoush where Lesh invited Sally McManus to debate him. So that just shows the difference between me and Matthew, because I spent Sunday trying not to die. He challenges the head of the ACTU to a debate. Hey, something matters to me. Thinking about some issues we could discuss in a potential debate. Here's six topics, and I won't go through them all, but one, the trade union movement's historic support for the White Australia policy. Two, how the minimum wage locks low education, young and minority Australians out of the workforce. He goes on and on, blah, blah, blah. What does she say? Mate, you are this is from Simon Manus to Matthew Lesh. Mate, you are a policy advisor for a union bashing think tank. The best you will get is Sunday Arvo Sport on Twitter. So Matthew does not denied. Keep going, mate. We'll get it up there. Eventually it will happen.
I don't know what she means by the best you've got is Sunday Arvo Sport on Twitter.
Well, it was Sunday Arvo, and that was this was her Sunday Arvo.
Oh, sport. That's sport.
Yeah.
That's sport to these people.
Yeah. Yeah. And by these people, we include Matthew.
Yeah, I just include nerds in general to me. I'm sorry.
Cool. So anyway, Lesh getting fighty on Twitter, and I had a great friend watch post out yesterday about the minimum wage.
Yes, absolutely. That's it for our topics at the start of the show. Make sure you guys stick around. We've got an interview with Andrew Bushnell and Robert Toombs on the other end of this, and then we're going to be having some fun with some stories on the other end of those interviews. So if you guys like this podcast, thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for downloading and subscribing. We are available on iTunes, SoundCloud, and our website, so make sure you guys are checking in and downloading, subscribing on any of the channels that you prefer. If you are subscribed on iTunes, there's an option to leave us a review through a number of stars. Make sure you leave us 5. It helps us with the ratings. You can also enter your own little comment, tips for the show, and your own Q&A clap moment, and we'll read it out on air. So make sure you guys are doing that. Nina, if people like the podcast a lot and they want to get really involved with the IPA and what we're doing, where can they go to become a member?
Oh, it's easy. Just visit the website, ipa.org.au, and click on the join button. And starting as low as $22 per year, you can become a member, and you'll receive four free editions of IPA Reviews, our own magazine.
Very cool. Let's go to those interviews. Okay, we are now joined once again by great friend of the show, IPA Research Fellow, Andrew Bushnell. Andrew, welcome back.
Oh, well, thanks for inviting me back. Finally, it feels like it's been a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, a lot of people are out there saying that someone dropped out of an interview moments ago, so we had to text Andrew on the fly. That's hearsay. Yeah. As far as I'm concerned, that's just rumours.
I'm heartbroken to hear this.
Oh, well.
I was thinking, your beauty, they want me back.
We've been preparing all week.
I mean, because I know that there's this groundswell of support for having me on the show more.
We talked about this.
See, I haven't forgotten.
He received a groundswell of one email that he's been going about.
Okay, in fairness, we have been actually getting a lot of good responses from Andrew's appearances on the show.
They
love surprise everyone. So, Andrew... huge week. So Ben and I have had a bit of fun with this already, talking about 10 years since the 2020 Ideas Summit.
Yes.
But there's a wider point to be made, which is sometimes governments do backfire when they get the quote-unquote best and brightest in a country together to come up with policies. What do you make of 2020 Ideas Summit and wider just like intelligentsia communities?
Well, if you hadn't just called me up off the bench to come do
subs in.
And this for this 2020 Summit, I would never have noticed that it had been 10 years since then. In fact, the entire incident I'd basically blotted from my memory. And I think that's because the entire thing is just flawed in its basic conception. This idea that you get in Australia's best and brightest, as you called it, or really just the best connected, the people who, you know, were mates with Kevin Rudd and, you know, wanted to go to this thing. The idea that they're going to sit down and just, you know, put their big brains together and come up with like a new direction for the country. It's just insane. It's not how a country works. Yeah. And even if it were how your country worked, then that's the thing you should change. You know, your country was being directed by 100 people who are mates with Kevin Rudd, then that's the problem to address. So the number one recommendation from the 2020 summit would have been never have another 2020 summit.
We should never do this again. Can I tell you two big winners from the summit that we might not be discussing? One, Kevin Rudd's selfie storage, because there were a lot of celebrities there. So Kevin Rudd got a lot of selfies with
do selfies in 2008, James?
Well, I got photos with them, I guess. But like Kate Blanchett was on the board of people picking the best and brightest.
Blanchett.
Is that Blanchett?
Fancy.
Kate Blanchett?
I call her Kate Blanchett, but I mean,
churching it up a little bit. Well, I mean, that's kind of
I'm sure she would say Blanchett. There's no way she's gone Blanchett.
Yeah. It's kind of a Hollywood thing.
Yeah. And whoever makes butcher's paper in Canberra, they would have absolutely made out as bandits. Yeah.
No, surely it would have been environmentally friendly. They would have had the whiteboards.
Oh, true. Etch-a-sketches and stuff like that.
Is a chalkboard more environmentally friendly than a whiteboard?
I certainly hope not.
I would guess it was.
Yeah, but like, it's just icky. I hated writing on chalkboards. Always have. Big whiteboard guy. It's just smoother.
Well, covering the big issues today in the thing, but I mean,
that's another bit of hypocrisy. That's all. Yeah, another layer.
The 2020 thing, though, I mean, that's just meant to be your civil society. So let's come up with the ideas to, you know, make the country better. Isn't that just our civil society?
You should be doing that anyway. Mm. You know, that's what for example, the Institute of Public Affairs is for.
Yeah.
You don't need to call a grand convention of all these people that you expect to hear. And the thing is, it's, you know, you game it, so you expect to hear things that you want to do anyway, like something like, say, the NDIS, which came out of it. Unless you're open to surprises, but even then, I was going to say, unless you're open to surprises, the whole thing's pointless, but even then, the whole thing is pointless. Yeah. I don't want to undercut my main point, which is that this thing was an absolute boondoggle.
Boondoggle. Why? The IPA didn't get invited.
Shock and horror.
I thought we'd get invited now.
No, absolutely. To Kevin Rudd's idea summit. Yeah, because absolutely.
If they did it again, they'd have to have someone from the blockchain hub.
Yeah.
You can't just cut out the future like that. Exactly. Apparently,
Darcy would break in, just crash every conference. Just how about blockchain, guys?
Yeah.
Cool. So we'll move on. I can't read your notes from over here, Pete. So what have you got?
I've got PhD chat.
Oh yes, that's pretty good news. So Andrew Bushnell is joining the ranks of IPA people who are currently pursuing a PhD. Yep. Andrew, tell us about it.
All right.
Don't finish before me.
To be honest, after starting it, I now think that's less likely.
Really?
I sort of got daunted a couple of weeks in because I'm doing the coursework as well at the moment. I'm just trying to clear all that out of the way. And so there's all these other like little hurdle requirements, as you would remember.
Research methods.
Yes. And it's actually that part of it's kind of annoying. But my topic is, I guess this is the bit that would be of interest to the members since, the IPA is sort of supporting me through this. So it's good for the members to know what I'm doing with my time. What I'm writing about is, and I'll say it in like a really like philosophical way and then I'll explain what it is. But
okay.
So at the moment, what I'm researching is the analytical foundations of conservatism.
Okay.
And what that means is analytical philosophy is this English tradition of philosophy of inquiring into what the concepts in a school of philosophy really mean, right, and how they connect to each other.
Okay.
And so there's not a lot of work done on this in conservatism, mostly because conservatism is kind of an anti-rational tradition. So it's kind of has never really sat down and explained how all the value claims that it's making connect to one another.
It's sort of organic and accumulated and...
Exactly, because it's sort of about doctrine rather than theory.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's about practice, what things have been done over time. And so that sort of opens up this possibility of, well, okay, is there a way of sort of rationally defending this, what sometimes gets called a status quo bias, so a bias towards what we already have? I don't think it's quite that simple, but that's one way of thinking about it. And so the idea is in this PhD to look at the underpinning value claims of conservatism and then build up from that to a new sort of defence of our existing social institutions like freedom of speech, parliamentary democracy, these things that we all care about defending here in Australia. Is there another way of creating sort of a rational platform to underpin our defence of those things?
That is interesting. So with this rational platform, what do you got so far?
What have I got so far? So what I'm writing on the moment is a friend of the IPA, Geoffrey Brennan at ANU, who's a libertarian economist, sort of works in that PPE space that you're in and Chris is in and things like that. He wrote over the course of time, 10 years, he wrote like a series of papers about this analytical idea of conservatism.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sort of writing a response to his idea from a conservative perspective and just trying to flesh out that idea. And then hopefully, we'll be able to go from there into some sort of applied examples
of
things that actually exist in politics.
Very
to give it a bit more of concrete and less theoretical.
Yeah. Meat. So what is your estimate of when you'll be finished?
Well, James, these things take time.
I don't know where I'm going with this.
Well, no, no, because I'm pretty old to be starting, I think.
How old are you?
I'm 34.
Okay.
So
he's a baby-faced assassin, Bushy.
Yeah.
He's as he says, 34.
Yeah. I mean, you don't quite get the full effect of my youthfulness on the radio or on the podcast. But the 3 years from now, or 3.5 years from now, so whatever that is.
Okay. Pete, when do you reckon you'll be finished by?
A draft of my thesis is sitting in the inbox of Professor Sinclair Davidson and also Professor Jason Potts as we speak.
So,
and I'm seeing Sink on Monday.
Yeah, but these are all facts of the case. Yeah. When do you reckon you'll be finished?
Oh, well, it depends what Sink says. He might go, you've got to do these 12 things.
Yep.
Or he might say, you know what, mate, you just got to start again. This is crap.
This is a danger for Bolt. He's definitely going to be relegated to sidekick status if you become Dr. Pete Gregory.
Oh, well, no.
Then
I'll just become even more antsy.
My views will become so much more weighty once I am accepted into the
academy. They'll go up to 1 gram. I still think Andrew's going to finish first. That's my bold prediction. I want the sound check. I don't need this
kind of pressure.
Mate, yeah. No, I mean, he's a long way back, but he might.
Well, Richmond were last year in the fourth quarter against Melbourne. We'll talk about that later.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm about that far back. Yeah. We all know how that ended.
You do.
Well.
5 goals. The last
quarter. Nah, a couple. Yeah. But we had no one on the bench. Anyway. Yeah. we're robbed that night.
That's foreshadowing, not preempting.
Yes, absolutely. So we'll move on to another topic.
Yeah.
So this was a story that got a fair bit of play this week. The Greens announced their big new national policy. Big vision for Australia. Surprisingly, not much to do with economics, tax, or anything. It was legalizing weed. Yeah. Now,
smoke weed every day.
Yep.
Felt a bit desperate.
There was a bit of an introduction from Nate Dogg to the press conference.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, this is a classic conservative v. libertarian argument. There's a lot of different opinions in this room about whether or not weed should be legalized. But Bushnell, what did you make of the Greens?
That is a big pro.
Well,
I should point out that today is the 20th of April, so happy 420 day out there for all our listeners. So light one up and listen to what Bushnell thinks.
I think
that's staying at the show.
I think the politics of it sort of came across as a bit desperate, right? It's like the Greens, their vote has been stagnating. You've got a Labor Party that's really committed to a kind of Jeremy Corbyn style left wing populist campaign,
really?
Trying to box them out on the left. The Greens are led by Richard Di Natale, who's much more from the what gets called derisively on social media the tree Tory part of the Greens.
That's good.
Which is like, because he's very much like a middle class guy from the suburbs of Melbourne. In years past, someone like him would have been from the sort of possibly even from the moderate part of the Liberal Party, the left part of the Liberal Party.
Yeah.
And so they have a split internally between their sort of red Greens. And then they have guys like him, or more sort of, I guess, blue green,
which is hilarious.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is funny.
This idea that they have their little factions, and like, and that Richard Di Natale is just simply not radical enough. You know.
Yeah. Well,
what about last year? I can't remember who it was, but who went down and then just was like, "I'm taking you all down with me." These people are unable to serve in Parliament due to dual citizenship. I can't remember who it was. It was like Lee Rhiannon, I think it was. She went down, and then a week later, two of her enemies in the Greens were exposed as dual citizens. It was Godfather stuff.
I don't keep a close enough eye on Greens politics.
We probably should. Although that said, I mean, with Labor running the way they are, you know, you can sort of safely turn your back on the Greens a little bit. And that's why they're talking about something like legalizing marijuana, because it's like a way of pushing back into their sort of youth or young lean. You know, the youth vote is really like a bunch of sort of 35-year-old online journalists. You know, they write for like these online magazines, and they call themselves youth correspondents, and they're 35, and they sort of have a tragic addiction to skateboard shoes.
Follow Bushy on Twitter for more of this stuff.
Speaking of Twitter, I genuinely believe the sort of Twitter brigade in Australia, like MSN Watchdog and all the people that we always get notifications from, I genuinely believe the average median age of like a Twitter user from the left these days is like 64.
Really?
Just the language they use, how little they seem to understand of tagging, I think it's old people.
Yeah,
it's my genuine theory.
Well, my dad's not on Twitter, but he does love Facebook.
Yeah.
He's old.
And he loves an emoji. No, that was Morgan.
Yeah.
So my other point about the Greens wanting to legalize weed is that, like, where's their support for vaping? Like, if we should have, like, we should be able to smoke weed, then also you should be allowed to vape.
Yeah. So are they officially against vaping?
Well, I haven't seen their policy position. Like, there's some Greens who are quite pro-vaping. And, like, 2 years ago, one New South Wales Green MP did vape in Parliament, which is so baller. But, obviously, if they're going to talk about weed like this, they should also talk about vaping, because vaping will actually save lives. And if the same principles apply, and if you do want to stop people smoking, then surely vaping is a way to go.
Yeah, I think it's funny. I mean, that there is this objection to vaping, which seems to be much more closely analogous to the situation under the law now, right? So we allow smoking, right? That's not going to change. And it seems to me that using, you know, e-cigarette is like much closer to the current situation. And so it's a much less dramatic shift in the law than, say, legalizing some totally other substance, right? Some totally different thing. And so, I mean, from my perspective, I can understand why you'd want to, you know, allow marijuana for medicinal purposes. I don't personally support going down the route of legalizing the use of all drugs, because I do think there are downstream effects of that you don't want to deal with in society. And that sort of, you know, without pivoting too much to my criminal justice work, like, I do think that, you know, you don't want to be feeding into these things that are known to correlate with other kinds of offending. So I wouldn't go that far. But something like vaping, I don't really understand why that hasn't got, you know, it should be easy enough for that to get some sort of cut through. And yet it's kind of become siloed or like isolated within a kind of a libertarian subset of the Liberal Party and the Liberal Democrats. And it hasn't really broken out of that. And I can't really give you an answer for why not.
I just think it's because people, like, you know, you got the Cancer Council, people that campaign against cigarettes, and they're presented with e-cigarettes, which are obviously safer than cigarettes and are shown to stop people smoking if they move to e-cigarettes. But the problem is they just look like cigarettes. Like, I genuinely, that's the only argument I can see people making, is that they look like cigarettes and that cigarette companies will just start making e-cigarettes and they don't want people, these companies, to keep making money.
Wait, you're telling me politicians just make snap judgments with no depth?
Well, yeah, Pete. Yes.
They don't look cool, though. I mean,
they don't look cool.
Like, no, they definitely do not look cool.
Like, you look, you know, I'm just to be clear, I am saying that we should make this possible, but you look like a knob.
There's plenty of things that, you know, we allow that make people look uncool. Like, Velcro is still legal.
I reckon Velcro is cool.
Mate.
Anyway, I think we're up to our target for the interview in terms of minutes.
Cool. Yeah, Bushnell, thank you so much for bailing us out.
Same, mate.
No worries.
I asked Professor Toombs about the differences between the elites and the populists over Brexit.
There has been a tradition of, I think, of a sort of intellectual and cultural separateness on the part of the English elite, the part of the intelligentsia, which, you know, one could perhaps rather fancifully trace back to nonconformity, perhaps not all that fancifully, but it can certainly be traced back to the sort of the sense of separateness that George Orwell writes about, to support in some cases for particular ideologies. I think of it as being a sort of internal exile, people who feel that they're not really part of the mainstream. There's a sort of whole package of ideas which are socially and morally progressive, often republican, or at least not very monarchist. Often, there's a certain degree, perhaps, of what's sometimes called self-hatred. I don't think that's really the right term, but a sense that one isn't really part of this history and of this sort of, you know, popular Englishness. Orwell says something like, the English intelligentsia would sooner be caught stealing from a poor box than standing up for the national anthem. And there's something of that in this attitude, of a deep sense of dislike of anything that smacks of popular patriotism or popular nationalism, and a desire to be part of a cosmopolitan framework which distinguishes one from what's seen as a crude and vulgar English patriotism. There's a fear of being regarded as chauvinistic or xenophobic. So UKIP, Nigel Farage, are sort of the bogies of this view. So you must distance yourself from anything that could seem to be in sympathy with what's seen as popular xenophobia. There is, I think, there has emerged at least this contempt for the majority, which I think is we haven't seen for a very long time. And I don't think it's been part of political discourse since the middle of the 19th century, the idea that some people are not really, don't really have the right to make political decisions because they're too stupid or that they're too reactionary. And therefore, decisions ought to be left to an elite. So on the part of certain anti-Brexit partisans, you suddenly have a very exaggerated account of parliamentary sovereignty. Although, of course, parliamentary sovereignty was very much compromised by membership of the EU. So there's a clear irony, if not an insincerity, in suddenly claiming parliamentary sovereignty. But parliamentary sovereignty has always been limited to lawmaking. Parliament does not make fundamental decisions, as it were, without reference to the electorate. The idea that somehow members of parliament embody sovereignty in some way that separates them from the will of the majority is simply a historical and constitutional nonsense.
Can you explain a bit more about declinism?
Yeah. And a number of countries are subject to this. We are, the British, the French have been, the Americans, it seems to me today, are. This idea that things were once in the past much better than they are now, that one has to somehow reassert the greatness of the country if you're someone like Trump, or indeed perhaps someone like Emmanuel Macron in France. But the other reaction is to think, well, you know, everything's awful. There's nothing that is worth defending. Nothing can be done to rescue us from our merited fate and so on. And that, or that we're not capable of governing ourselves, we're not capable of existing in the world independently, because we're now, and this is quite, one hears this quite commonly, we're just a little island off the coast of Europe of no importance, and therefore the idea that we should govern ourselves or make our own choices is as people would say, imperialist nostalgia. Again, to return to the Brexit vote, I agree that some people have said, and I agree, that this was essentially a vote of confidence in our institutions, not in our politicians, but in the institutions themselves. But often politicians and often opinion formers seem to regard the foundations of the democratic system as being dispensable.
But yet they're only there because of the democratic
system.
They are,
yes.
Mm. They don't seem to remember that.
Not always. Well, it's very dangerous to think that you know best.
Yes.
And that somehow your authority comes from yourself and not by delegation. And I think that there certainly is a danger that that elites assume that they themselves have a right to rule. They haven't.
They've been chosen by the people.
Yes.
So what do you think would happen if this determined and sort of powerful minority, these elites, could actually ultimately overturn the democratic decision of the public in terms of Brexit?
Well, I think it's impossible to predict precisely what would happen. But I think it would first of all have proved that the populist narrative is true, that the political elite did not represent the people, that they did not respect the people's choice. And to say things like, well, the people didn't know what they were voting for, is simply a way of undermining democratic choice. You could say that democratic electorates never know what they're voting for. if somehow this popular verdict was overturned, and after all, it wasn't simply a referendum vote, it was also confirmed by votes in Parliament and by a general election, that this would seem to prove that a populist narrative was true, that somehow there was an irresponsible elite that was governing in its own interests, that democracy was a sham. And if that belief is encouraged or created, then of course the consequences are very dangerous and I think unpredictable. But I think there would be some sort of constitutional and political crisis. And that's something that the people who advocate this course of action never seem to consider, something they certainly never discuss. What exactly do they think would happen if they got their way? They seem to think we'll just go back to the way things were before 2016, but that can't happen. I think the danger of doing huge damage to the political system is quite considerable. But it is worrying that in a number of countries there seems to have developed a detachment between the elites and the masses. What the cause of that is quite difficult to say. One could say, well, it's all down to the financial crisis 2008 and so on, but I think that's probably a bit simplistic. This must have been happening for a longer time. If that global elite regards itself as having no responsibility to the people among whom they live, then its own position is very vulnerable. And it's hard to see that society remains a very viable one.
Cool, thank you to Andrew and Professor Robert Toombs for those interviews. And thank you to Dr. Bella DeBrera. Obviously, the last 3 weeks have been a lot of Robert Toombs chat, and we really thank her for all those cool questions. So we'll now go through some stories that have made us laugh this week. So we're dusting off Q&A clap. It's been a few weeks. I've missed it. I've missed it dearly. Bringing it back. The British Labour Party. Obviously, a lot of friends of Q&A clap kind of stuff have announced their policy to introduce free bus passes for people under the age of 25. Hmm. According to their own estimates, the policy will cost £1.4 billion.
Is that how much?
Yeah.
Crikey.
And it's like, obviously, there's like all this politicking in the UK as to whether or not it's a good policy. And
it's not.
It's not a good policy.
Spoiler alert.
What I also like, though, is like, our friends, Institute of Economic Affairs, really cool British think tank, have said, isn't this the same government, like talking about the Conservatives cracking down on the policy? Aren't you the same people that lifted the age limit for the 16 to 25 rail cards, or like student prices, from 25 years to 30 years? So it's like, you know, the Conservatives are saying, oh, you're bribing young people. It's like, yes. Well, so are you.
The Conservatives in Britain are absolutely hopeless.
Yes, absolutely.
As we will get to later.
Yes, bring back Dan Hannan. That's my tip. Or Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Do you know, I've got one other thing for you.
Yeah, go.
Dr. Bella DeBrera.
Oh.
She had a piece in the Times this week, which is very popular, and which I pointed out to her that the Queen probably read, because the Queen reads the Times, and it was about the Empire.
How did she take that?
Her little head exploded.
Yeah.
She was like, oh my God.
She would absolutely love that.
Yeah. And I said, you know, it was a very strong piece, and she said, these people are evil, Peter. So she got fired up.
She got very fired up. Cool. So anyway, let's go back to this. So obviously it is bribing young people, and it's just like, how do we get young people to vote for us even more? Free bus passes.
Yes.
Let's just do that for no reason.
It's not even that imaginative.
Yeah. So anyway, Q&A clap. What should a good policy be in the sense of just basically bribing people, I guess?
Mm-hmm.
Kick us off, Pete.
I would like to make a brave stand about this.
Oh, okay, brave stand.
Everyone should get $1 million.
Okay. Thank you.
I'll vote for you.
Stole mine.
Nina's on board.
You stole mine.
Well, I said it yesterday in the meeting.
Mine was just Labour's next policy should just be I get $20.
Well, you got to do.
I got to think of one on the fly here.
Oh, that was funny.
Yeah.
That was. You've got to dream
exact
big.
Same joke.
Yeah. You got to dream big.
Well,
James.
You know, it's just a bit of walking around money. Hang on, let me think of one on the fly. All right, okay. Labour's next policy should be that. Young people just get everything for free and it's paid for by over 65s.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, cool. Okay. Yeah, well, that's why I like preparing my Q&A class. So Pete and I are going to have to probably discuss that. Yep. Anyway, cool. So, yeah, obviously, as I've said before on the show, if you do like the Q&A class segment, if you do want your own brave stand or just basic policy position that will always invariably get a clap on Q&A for no apparent reason, make sure you're leaving for us in the iTunes comments after you give us a 5-star review, and we'll read it out on the show and you can have your own little...
Send them in.
Cool. So, Pete, what have you got for us?
Well, Chick-fil-A. Yes. Did I say it correctly?
You did.
For the first time I said it correctly. Issue close to my heart. Such a big fan of fried chicken. Now, this is... Okay. What do I reckon? So, what happened? I'll give you the backstory. These people have started opening these restaurants in New York. They're a massive fast food chain in the United States. They've opened a few things in New York. Piece of New Yorker this week, The New Yorker, which is a magazine, said that the infiltration of Chick-fil-A in New York was creepy because the owners are Christians.
Ooh.
What annoys me is I reckon it's so easy to get a job as a columnist on the left. Like, you can just write the stupidest, thoughtless garbage. And, like, The New Yorker is not an insignificant magazine.
No, it's pretty
big. That's a big deal.
Yeah.
I'd love to be published in The New Yorker. And you can just get in by writing garbage.
Yeah, just, well, get morally outraged by something and they'll be all ears.
But it's not even, it's like, oh, they're Christian. There's something going on here.
Yeah.
Anyway,
they close on
the
Sundays.
Why? Christian
they close on Sundays.
Can't sell chicken?
That's right, Nana. That's the point?
So Chick-fil-A got a lot of negative coverage 2 years ago because the people that run Chick-fil-A, obviously they are quite Christian and they were donating to organisations that argue against abortion. And so... I think that a job of a sandwich store is to make good sandwiches, but some people think that they also have to have the policy positions consistent with them, so like them themselves. So when they open in New York, this guy absolutely loses it. Can I quote one part of the paragraph that got me banging my head against the table pretty hard? The emphasis on community, especially... this one's too long a setup, but it's like, the emphasis on community suggests an ulterior motive. The restaurant's corporate purpose still begins with the words to glorify God, and that, I don't even know what this word is, proselytism thrums below the surface. No, it's tism. See that?
Oh, yeah.
Thrums below the surface of Fulton Street Restaurant, which has the ersatz homespun ambience of a mega church. If you've ever written that sentence, you have to retire from journalism. That is not a sentence. That's just a collection of words that you know.
And it's not a thing, like, it's, yeah.
Anyway, that's my big stand. Anyway, shall we move on?
Yeah, move on.
All right, cool. Now, last week we talked about Mark Zuckerberg. Sorry, Nina, how did you say his name?
Zuckerberg.
So last week we talked about his appearance before the Senate, talking about all the privacy concerns. And we were sort of talking about how the government absolutely had no idea what Facebook was, but did decide to say that they were thinking about regulating it. And we were like, well, hang on, shouldn't you figure out what it was? Mm. Or just not regulate it at all. But there's another angle that we didn't take that's also quite interesting. But anyway, one of the senators there, Senator Leahy, he said, we Vermonters believe in privacy. And privacy is obviously very important to this senator and et cetera. And he wants to make sure everyone thinks he's privacy. But if you go to his website, Leave Vermont, with the Chrome extension Facebook Pixel Helper, it reveals that Senator Lee is a Facebook Pixel invisible to users, so you don't know you're accessing it, that gathers user data of the Facebook users who visit his site. So if you go to his campaign website, your data, including your demographics and what pages you looked at on the site, have been placed into a custom data targeting ordinance by Lee's team. It's like,
is that literally using Facebook?
Yeah. Well, he's using Facebook externally, like not on Facebook. His website uses your Facebook stats to build a profile of you so he can target himself to you.
Wow.
Believe in privacy, though. Really believes in privacy.
Do you know what? Having watched this thing unfold, there's a strong chance he doesn't even know that his website is doing that.
Yeah, but also...
And
don't do that.
Yeah. It's like all these senators, people do that.
No, but all these senators grandstanding, like, oh my God, people's privacy is being hacked into by this private organization that they've willingly signed up to. It's like, mate, you run NSA. Like, people run NSA that are actually spying on people.
Like, I'm pretty sure the US government watches me through my phone. And if they're not, they should be. I mean, we are certainly...
What's in your phone?
That's eight. Most people have a file, Pete, as a filing cabinet.
Yeah, I've got my own desk officer.
It's got a 5-man team watching him at the FBI.
Yeah, you got to do your stint on the Gregory file before you know, to cut your teeth. Anyway, but yeah, I mean, these people are completely hypocritical. I assume
it's the first thing an intern does.
I assume that every company and every political figure that you ever just collects all your data and that's life. As I keep saying, you don't have to have a Facebook account.
Yeah.
You know? True. Just off-grid mode.
Off the grid.
Off the grid. All of us have Facebook accounts. I like us going. Gotta be off the grid. Gotta be a rabble.
I like Facebook. It helps me keep up with birthdays. All right, let's move on. Straws. Straws have been a strong campaign issue for this podcast.
Absolutely. In fact, since we're doing it for like now the third or fourth week, yeah. I came up with a segment title for any straw related topics. Straw man arguments.
Yeah. Good on you. Straw man arguments. So
I'll hit the lab and start doing some theme music for it.
It's something we can, we can hit the lab.
Yeah, take Saul aside for a few seconds.
Yeah, take him like,
is this half really work related?
Stop doing the financial report. And we need to. Anyway, straws. So the thing is, this is actually, having read into this a little bit this morning, James, this is actually much worse. And no, this is actually much worse than I thought. They're just going to ban straws.
Cool.
In the UK.
For the UK. Theresa May promises to introduce a ban on the sale of plastic straws, drink stirrers and cotton buds. So that's hygienic. So by the end of the year, as she urges Commonwealth leaders to tackle climate change and clean up the world's oceans. That is literally the most reprehensible sentence I've ever read.
That's pretty bad. That's worse than the New Yorker one. So like
that was the PM.
No plastic.
No plastic straws. How do people consume cocktails on the beach?
Exactly. I told you, bamboo straws.
Bamboo straws.
People, listen to me.
All right, invest in the bamboo market in UK right now. That's investment advice.
Nina's got shares in some bamboo straw company.
Yeah, and she's
John Law's cash for comments. just had a little incursion from Bushnell.
Yeah, just heard the straw ban. He's come running in.
Anyway, so that's that.
Yeah, cool. So I like to think that I've achieved a fair bit in life.
You haven't?
24. Well, I haven't, but I like to think it. It keeps me happy. But anyway, I'm 24. Like, you know, the podcasts are going quite well. You know, I got a job, etc. That 9-year-old kid that said that straws were a massive issue. So for people that weren't listening, like all these straws are polluting the world stuff comes back to a 9-year-old kid's survey on a phone that he did for a school project.
Yeah.
That's it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was. Yeah, they came up with a figure of 500 million straws a day in America.
Yeah.
And all these agencies were quoting it.
Yeah.
And then they looked into it. Reason looked into it, and it was this kid who rang straw companies.
Yeah. That 9-year-old kid has now brought two governments to its knees over this straw ban. I've done nothing.
Well, you know, I've done pick something and get it banned.
Yeah, all right, well, I will. Cool, so we'll fly through. What else have we got here?
Christian Tom Victoria.
Okay, speaking of kids bringing governments to their knees.
Yes.
So primary school children, this came out of the Herald Sun, primary school children are being turned away from state parliament during question time because of fears they will be exposed to bullying.
To bullying?
Yeah, as in like, so there's a bit too much rampant chat happening down there on the floor, so we got to get the kids out of here because they might just see adults, you know, talking.
Are they admitting that there's bullying?
Well, I just think they're freaking out over nothing.
I reckon that, like, there's nothing said in Parliament that the kids haven't heard in the playground anyway.
Well, yeah, exactly.
So who's the kids in this scenario?
Right, so it's like the embarrassing policy change comes amid concerns about worsening behaviour in the Legislative Assembly, with politicians calling each other grubs, scabs, liars, imbeciles and dickhead.
Yeah, which they are. So, I mean, thankfully, a politician finally speaking the truth.
Yeah, like, what 10-year-old kid is going, how dare that person call him a scab?
Yeah. Yep. They're like, you know, mining their data on Facebook.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. So what else have we got, Pete?
Well, this is a big story for all of us. Transparent bins in WA. So it's what's happening is, now we have a long-time listener who goes by the name of Binju, so we're very interested in this one. There's the Mindaree Regional Council in Western Australia. What are you looking like that for? We've got a listener called Binju. He loves bins. It's a long story. I'll explain afterwards. So the Mindaree Regional Council in Western Australia is putting out 20 transparent bins so that people in that municipality can demonstrate what they're chucking out. Like, it's meant to kind of shame people and to stop chucking rubbish out or large amounts of rubbish out. They said there are no plans to put all residents' rubbish on display. Yeah, right. That will definitely happen. Yeah, this
what's that folder in red there? Don't look at that.
Yeah, I mean, there's all stuff that we want to chuck out.
Yeah,
that we don't want people to see.
Yeah,
you know, socks with holes in them and stuff like that.
Exactly. Well, it's like I'm already embarrassed by how many of my dinners are just from Uber Eats.
Yeah.
I certainly don't want neighbours now knowing that as well.
Uber Eats bags.
It's Like, is that how you live your life? Yes, that is. Thank you, Perth government.
So they're literally like, the whole logic behind this is to get to shame people. Like, do they literally just sit down and think, okay, let's think of what tactics have been used by totalitarian governments and then implement them into our policies?
Oh, because like the IPA has also always got a fair bit of mileage from the Herald Sun over like, if the second a council starts looking through people's bins and giving them a ticket saying you're not recycling properly, like Herald Sun will invariably call us up and just be like, can we have a comment? And we'll give it and it'll go well. So we're obviously in state government's heads.
Yeah.
Because they're like, we can now no longer go around looking in people's bins. So what if the bins were transparent and we, you know, I just happen to be walking by now.
And everyone's
so we're in their head.
Okay, I like that. I like that, right?
Yeah, that's my theory about it. Cool, so that's it for the show this week. Thank you to Andrew Bushnell and Professor Robert Toombs for those chats. Make sure you guys are subscribed on iTunes, SoundCloud, and our website if you guys want to keep in touch with future podcasts. And make sure you guys become a member. Nina, how can people become a member?
So while you're browsing in the websites looking for the podcast, don't forget to click on the join button.
Join button.
Join button, please. So starting as low as $22 per year, you can become a member. And you, while you're becoming a member, you will be receiving for free editions of IPA reviews and also exclusive invitations to IPA events.
Very cool. Very good show, guys. Should we time capsule it?
Yes, please.
Absolutely. All right, see ya.
See ya. You know, I cherish you, my love.